History of Macedonia. Alexander the Great. The March to Issus. Now, assembling a great army was one thing. Using it successfully was another. Hindsight tells us, as it did many ancient authors, that facing Alexander the Great and his Macedonians in a pitched battle was unwise. Just as Memnon had supposed that have recommended avoiding battle and starving the enemy in 334 BCE, other Greeks are credited with voicing similar wise counsel a year later. Charidemus, the mercenary leader, became an Athenian citizen who fled to Persia rather than surrender to Alexander after the fall of Thebes, was especially vocal. He had urged Darius and the bulk of his army to stay well away from the Macedonians and to instead send a detachment, allegedly 100,000 men, including 30,000 Greek mercenaries, to deal with him, hinting that he was the best man to command. Doubts were raised about the Greek's loyalty as well as his plan, and it would have been strange after raising such a great army only to employ part of it. Numbers were on Darius's side. However large as his army actually was, and in many ways was his greatest disadvantage. Charidemus responded with more vigor than sense to the nobleman who spoke against him, doubting Persian manhood and courage. Abuse was every day in Athenian public life, but it was not the etiquette of the king of the king's court, and Darius ordered his execution. Diodorus claims that the mercenary was defiant to the end and shouted out that the king would regret killing him and soon witnessed the destruction of his own kingdom. Now, the route into Sicilia, chosen by Alexander, followed one of the main Persian roads and led to the Sicilian Gates, a pass through the mountains where at one point the track was barely wide enough for three or four men marching abreast. There were Persian troops already there, so Alexander halted his march some distance away and gave every sign of settling down for the night. The place was known as the Camp of Cyrus, for it had been used by the usurper's army at the end of the 5th century, including Xenophon and the 10,000. And the association probably pleased Alexander and his officers. It certainly pleased Arrian, who in another work styled himself as Xenophon. Hoping that the enemy would relax their guard under the cover of darkness, Alexander led out the usual strike force of Hypaspes, Agarians, and archers, and hurried straight at the pass. They didn't go unnoticed, but the aggression and allegedly the realization that Alexander was coming in person broke the nerve of the garrison. The Persians were outnumbered, and more importantly, had no prospect of relief by a larger force, however long they managed to hold out. So quite reasonably, they just fled. News arrived from the citizens of Tarsus that the local satrap had planned to flee, and they feared that he would sack the city before he went. Alexander took cavalry and light troops and appeared so quickly that the satrap ran off before he could do any harm. The river Cydnus flows through Tarsus to the sea. Almost 3 centuries later, Cleopatra would come here on her fabulous barge to meet Mark Antony, in a scene so wonderfully conjured by Plutarch and Shakespeare. In the ancient world, the river was known for its clear and very chilly water. Tired, sweat-stained, and hot from hard riding to secure the city, Alexander plunged in for a swim, only to be seized by cramps. By the time he was hauled out, he had succumbed to fever. Perhaps the shock was too much for his system after more than a year of marching, riding, and fighting over rugged country in all weathers. Or perhaps an infection he had already caught happened to break out at this moment. Either way, the king was seriously ill, unable to sleep properly, and seemed to be on the brink of death. There was no clear air with the army, and it was deep in enemy territory, adding to all the nervousness inevitable at a time of succession to the Argead throne. Harpalus, one of Alexander's friends who had been exiled by Philip after the Pixodarus affair, was prevented from fighting due to poor health, perhaps physical handicap, and instead served as the senior treasurer. In these uncertain times, he chose to flee, taking some of the money with him. In the long run, Alexander didn't hold him against his old friend, for Harpalus returned and was reinstated in 331 BCE. That was for the future. For the moment, the treasurer was not the only one to despair of Alexander's life. We are told that all save one of his royal physicians was unwilling to treat the king, that they would be blamed and punished when he died. The exception was Philip, an Arcanian who had tended to the king since he was a boy. He suggested the drastic remedy of a purge, and the king, always fascinated by medicine, agreed. As is often the case, the tradition for what happened is actually confused, but it claims that Parmenio sent a message warning Alexander of a report that Philip had been bribed by Darius to assassinate him. This is supposed to have arrived as the doctor was making up a potion. Alexander took the cup, handed the letter to Philip. As the doctor read the accusation, the king drained the draft to show his trust in a man he had known since childhood. First, Alexander grew much worse, and Philip applied poultices and other treatments. After a little while, Alexander recovered, whether from the cure or simply through his robust constitution. Illness did keep Alexander off his feet and inactive for a month or so, as summer faded in the autumn of 333 BCE. Apart from the sieges of Miletus and Halicarnassus, it was the longest he had stayed in one place since landing in Asia. The Sicilian plain, although encircled by mountain ranges, was famed for its rich soil, and as the harvest had come in, there was plenty of food to provide for the army. By the end of September, Alexander was active once more, overrunning more of Cilicia, extracting 200 talents from Soldi for its alleged Persian sympathy, while treating Malus far more generously. He passed Anchalus, founded by the Assyrian king, whose great monument lay near the decaying walls. The king was shown clapping and snapping his fingers, the inscription boasting that he had built Attalus and Tarsus in a single day, and advised onlookers to eat, drink, and make love, for in comparison, anything they did would not amount to the sound that the king made with his hands. Alexander spent a week putting on a show of force for the tribes of the Taurus Mountains, who were often enthusiastic raiders, before returning to Soli to celebrate a festival and the sacrifice to Asclepius, the god of healing, for his recovery. News arrived that Darius had formed a great army and was advancing, but the current location of the Persians was unknown. However, there was good news of local victories by the Macedonian officers tasked with protecting Asia Minor. Encouraged, and from the start eager to meet the Persians head-on, Alexander resumed his advance. Now, at this point, we are heading towards the Great Battle of Issus, so we'll be having several shows on that. Now, the sources for this, The Politics by Aristotle, The Histories by Herodotus, Histories, 12 volumes, by Diodorus Siculus, Peloponnesian War by Thucydides, and The Lives by Plutarch, Philip and Alexander, Kings and Conquerors by Goldsworthy, History of Macedonia, Volume 1 and Volume 2 by Hammond, In the Shadow of Olympus, The Emergence of Macedonia by Borgia. Some additional sources for the sections on Alexander rules would include, of course, Arians, The Campaigns of Alexander, In the Footsteps of Alexander the Great by Michael Wood, The Wars of Alexander the Great by Haeckel, and The Story of Alexander's Empire by Mahaffey. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.